Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Dispatch 25. Thanks for joining me. As always, I'd like to start by thanking you for your support. There's only a fraction of people listening to these bonus episodes compared to the main narrative, but you guys are the ones keeping this project going. I'd also like to thank those of you who submit questions. As I continue putting out these bonus episodes, we get more and more good questions. In this installment, I had over a dozen that I wanted to answer, but there's just not time to get to everyone. And as always, there are a lot of good questions that anticipate things I'll be talking about later in the main narrative. Anyway, without further ado, let's get started. First, Timur Baran asked, I am curious if Napoleon ever shared an opinion, thought, or even a plan regarding the Circassians or the Caucasus region. Napoleon would have considered the Caucasus very distant and probably somewhat mysterious. Most Frenchmen of this era probably would have thought of this region as part of the so-called Orient. The Caucasus was in a period of transition. Persia and the Ottoman Empire had traditionally exercised a great deal of influence in this part of the world, but both were now in decline. Meanwhile, the Russian Empire was on the rise, extending its control over the Caucasus, a process which would be more or less completed in the late 19th century. The Caucasus were being drawn closer to the European world, and in fact, many of the peoples of the Caucasus considered themselves Europeans. But it would take time for perceptions in Western Europe to catch up to these facts. Napoleon would have come into contact with Circassians during his time in Egypt. Many of the Mamluks were of Circassian origin, although they typically left the Caucasus as young boys and probably would not have seemed very Circassian to their relatives back home. I would guess he was also familiar with the stereotype of the so-called Circassian beauties. This was a common feature of Orientalist literature in the West. Circassian women were renowned for their charm and good looks, and often chosen as wives or concubines for the Ottoman sultans and other powerful monarchs and nobles throughout the Middle East. In the West, there was often a strange, titillating, and racist edge to discussions of the Circassian beauties. They were usually depicted as having fair hair and skin, with stereotypically European features, being despoiled by dark-skinned men with non-European features. We also know that Napoleon was very impressed with the non-Russian contingents of the Russian Imperial Army, who typically fought in a more traditional style of warfare. Many of these people would have come from the Caucasus. However, at this stage in history, there were probably not very many Circassians in the Russian ranks. Throughout this period, the Russian state was engaged in a brutal campaign of oppression against its Circassian subjects, which would ultimately see most of them either dead or expelled from their traditional homelands. Napoleon does not seem to have given much thought to the Caucasus. He did carry on diplomatic negotiations with the Persians, and was obviously very interested in both Ottoman and Russian affairs. But I've never seen any evidence of him talking or thinking very much about the area between these three countries. There is even the story of a renegade Georgian prince approaching Napoleon to ask his support against the Russians. This was later in the Napoleonic Wars, when Russia and France had become enemies once again, so you would think this might have interested Bonaparte, but apparently the prince was rebuffed. Judging by his apparent lack of interest in the Caucasus, I think Napoleon assumed this region would remain within the Russian sphere of influence after his final victory. We've discussed this in past episodes. The new order envisioned by Napoleon did include a role for Russia as one of the great powers, acting as a European bulwark in the East. I think, had he managed to achieve victory over the coalitions, the Caucasus would have been part of that bulwark. Next, Johnny Connolly asked, I am curious about the minor nobility in the Ancien Régime. How different would it be growing up in the minor gentry, as Napoleon did, versus in a wealthy peasant or bourgeois family? To what extent could wealth blur the lines between the estates? You've touched on a very hotly debated question in the historiography of the French Revolution. For years immediately after the Revolution, the widely accepted narrative went something like this. The Revolution was brought on by the fury of the have-nots against the haves. If you thought the Revolution was a good thing, you saw this as an outpouring of righteous anger against an oppressive and dysfunctional system. If you thought the Revolution was a bad thing, you saw this as a barbaric orgy of bloodshed, stirred up by cynical or sociopathic demagogues. The picture became more nuanced in the 20th century. Scholars moved away from looking only at the actions and mindsets of individuals and started looking more at the broad social, economic, and intellectual trends that influence entire societies and whole classes of people. The study of history started to be influenced by newer disciplines like sociology, economics, and psychology. Marxism was a huge influence on the historiography of the French Revolution, even among historians who didn't agree with Marx politically, including many who were not even on the political left. That's a big reason I've talked so much about Marx on this show. You can't understand how modern historians arrived at the current consensus view of the Revolution without understanding at least the basics of Marx's theories. The narrative of the Revolution that emerged from this period goes something like this. Under the old regime, there was a rigid legal and social barrier between the nobility and the commoners. Throughout the 17th and 18th centuries, the French bourgeoisie became more significant to the functioning of French society. Just in raw numbers, there were a lot more of them. Their economic power increased, and parts of the economy that were dominated by the bourgeoisie were becoming more important to the wider society. As their influence grew, the bourgeoisie also became more socially and intellectually self-confident, and more politically conscious. But their political power was not allowed to grow with them, and so they became resentful of a political and social system that needed their contributions but ignored their voices. Meanwhile, the nobility were guarding their privileges as jealously as ever, and opposed even token concessions to the rising middle class. The royal government was unable to mediate this conflict. As the king and his administration became increasingly discredited, the bourgeoisie were able to rise up and seize control of the government, turning France from a country ruled by a monarch for the nobles to a country ruled by a legislature that served the interests primarily of the bourgeoisie. Obviously, I'm generalizing quite a bit here, but this was more or less the orthodox view until roughly the late 20th century. I would wager a lot of you have read books that give this narrative, or learned it at university. I would not go so far as to say that this view has been rejected, but starting in the last quarter or so of the 20th century, scholars have been adding nuance to this picture. When you look closely at the Revolution, that relatively straightforward narrative of class conflict doesn't always fit. Most scholars do not deny that there was a conflict between the interests of the rising bourgeoisie and the interests of the old nobility, and between the antiquated system of the old regime and the more dynamic, modern, professionalized system envisioned by the revolutionaries. But modern scholars broaden this picture by bringing in other social, economic, and political trends, and finding ambiguities and contradictions within that established narrative. For instance, to get back to your question, the most recent scholarship generally views the bourgeoisie and the nobility as not quite as rigidly divided as the previous generation of historians sometimes suggested. They point to the fact that wealthy bourgeois families were often able to buy their way into the nobility. Those 20th century historians were aware of this, but they pointed to the social divide between these new aristocrats, referred to as the robe nobility, and the old guard aristocracy, referred to as the sword nobility. But modern scholarship has found that although people talked about this division, it doesn't seem to have always been observed in practice. For instance, marriages between robe nobles and sword nobles were not uncommon. Scholars have also come to question the aristocracy's role in the economy. This was a big part of that old 20th century orthodox view of the revolution, the idea that there simply were not very many aristocrats involved in the new economy of trade, shipping, finance, and manufacturing. Throughout this period, most French aristocrats were focused on their traditional source of economic power, landowning and agriculture. And not only that, even if they had taken an interest in the new economy, nobles were actually legally barred from many bourgeois professions. But more recent scholarship has found a more complicated picture. There were French aristocrats involved in the so-called new economy. They were usually just investors rather than acting as businessmen or professionals in their own right. But at least in some cases, the economic interests of wealthy aristocrats were tied up with those of the rising bourgeoisie. Conversely, many wealthy bourgeois families poured fortunes into obtaining noble titles and adopting the trappings of the aristocratic life. Sometimes they even bought agricultural land and old rural estates, literally buying into that old economy, which was previously seen as the sole preserve of the aristocracy. This was not universally true. There were also many wealthy commoners who rejected the aristocratic life. But those old status symbols still had a powerful hold on many people. And let's not forget, aristocratic status came with real tangible privileges. They enjoyed tax exemptions. There were high positions in the military and the government that were only open to the nobility. And there were unique opportunities for the children of noble families. You might remember from our very early episodes that Carlo Bonaparte, Napoleon's father, had worked tirelessly to get the family recognized as nobles after Corsica was conquered by the French. This was in large part because he wanted those opportunities for his children. You may remember that Napoleon was allowed to attend military school for free. In fact, he was actually paid a government stipend. This program was only open to aristocrats. After all, with the senior ranks of the military reserved for the nobility, why would the government pay to put commoners through officer training school? So to sum up, this is a controversial question. I think any scholar of this period would tell you the distinction between noble and commoner existed. This division was important, and it contributed to the revolution. But the question of what that division actually looked like in practical terms in individual people's lives is much more complicated. Looking at the Bonapartes, they certainly read and thought more like the wealthy bourgeoisie. Carlo Bonaparte was a nobleman, but he had been to law school, a very bourgeois profession. Joseph Bonaparte followed in his footsteps. In the most literal sense of the word, bourgeoisie simply means townspeople, and the Bonapartes did live in a normal home in the center of a major urban area, not in some manor house out in the country. However, this was not at all unusual for French aristocrats. Any nobleman who could afford to lived at least part of the year in the city, either Paris or the provincial capital. In fact, you were considered something of a country bumpkin or even an eccentric if you stayed at your estate year-round. The Bonapartes had bourgeois aspirations, and in many ways a bourgeois outlook. Think of Carlo's failed get-rich-quick schemes. He wasn't very good at it, but he was a wheeler and dealer by nature. Some of his peers probably would have considered that kind of thing beneath a true aristocrat. All that talk of interest and returns and dividends was for grubby little merchants and accountants, not true gentlemen. On the other hand, Carlo spent much of his life at Versailles, living in accommodations that were earmarked for the nobility and rubbing elbows almost exclusively with his fellow aristocrats, including some of the most eminent and well-bred people in the country. Napoleon and several of his younger brothers were all groomed for careers as military officers. As we've discussed in past episodes, commoners were barred from all but the most junior officers' ranks. The schools that trained officers were only open to the aristocracy, so this aspect of the Bonapartes' family life was definitely very aristocratic. There was also a part of their lives that was almost pre-feudal, something tribal. Their role as traditional clan chieftains of many of the people in the Ajaccio area. They took this position seriously. You may remember that old clan loyalties actually helped save Napoleon's life after Paoli turned against the revolution and declared the Bonapartes outlaws. The Bonapartes are actually a great example of the ambiguities in the divide between the nobility and the rising bourgeoisie. They were aristocrats, but they did not fit into that box quite as neatly as that old orthodox narrative of the revolution might suggest. Next, Queer Coyote asked, "A while back, you touched on the Russian, quote-unquote, woman who was fighting as a man. I know in the U.S. we have several stories like this from the Civil War. While it's hard to assign identities to historic persons, many of these, quote-unquote, cross-dressers sound much more like the modern understanding of transgender. But as a trans person and a professional historian, I'm very interested in trans history. Do we know anything about trans folks in the Western world at the time of the Napoleonic Wars?" For starters, I should say that gender studies are not my area of expertise. This is a very hot field right now. I'm sure there's a lot of stuff on the cutting edge that I'm not aware of that could shed some light on this question, that just hasn't trickled down to the poor podcasters yet. Another caveat before we dive in, as you pointed out in your question, when we talk about historical figures, we always need to be careful to approach them on their own terms, and not bring too much of our modern baggage into the discussion. It probably goes without saying that trans identity as it exists today did not exist in the Napoleonic era, and more broadly, their views on sex and gender were very different from ours. We can't say for certain that any figure of this period definitely would or would not be transgender if they lived today. With all that said, there have always been people who challenged or even transgressed societal expectations about sex and gender. We can, and I think should, talk about those people and their experiences, not only on their own merits, but for what their stories can tell us about the societies they lived in. Anyway, to get to your question, based on what I've read about women who served in uniform during the Napoleonic Wars, it's hard to make any general statements about their identities. For some, it does not actually seem like a complicated question. For whatever reason, they felt they needed to join the military. The military only accepted male recruits, and so they pretended to be men or boys. Their new identities were a ruse in service of some greater goal, and nothing more. Someone like that probably does not come close to our modern definition of transgender. I'd imagine many of these people would have been happy if they'd been free to simply serve openly as women. A lot of them spoke of their constant fear of being quote-unquote exposed. Some wrote of their guilt about telling a lie to their comrades and superiors. For others, it probably didn't feel so much like a lie. Their adoption of a male identity seems to have been more significant. Some of them seemed to really relish playing the role of a man. Some of them don't seem to have been playing at anything, but simply happy and comfortable living as a man within the male world of the army. This group is probably where you find people who would have been closer to our modern understanding of transgender. But even here, who knows? This was a time of very strict gender roles, particularly for women. Some of these people may have preferred living as men simply because it was a lot freer than life as a woman, or they had personalities that were better suited to military life than anything they could have done under their assigned gender. Remember, they had been raised to believe the army was a man's world, and soldiering was a man's profession. Perhaps when they found they liked it or were good at it, this led them to believe they must be a bit male. There is also a very old archetype of a woman sacrificing her femininity for some greater cause. The most famous and influential Western European example is, of course, Joan of Arc. Modern research suggests her gender identity might have been a bit more complicated than the traditional narrative suggests. But that narrative might have been an inspiration for some of these people. I'm honestly not sure how that idea fits in with our modern concepts of gender. The idea that a person is authentically female, but has chosen to sacrifice that part of themselves to some higher calling. So there is a lot of ambiguity, and a lot of concepts that do not translate directly into our modern worldviews. With all that said, there were people in this era who seem like very good candidates to be transgender in the modern sense. In your question, you brought up maybe the most obvious and most interesting example, the person known to history as Nadezhda Durova, the so-called cavalry maiden of the Russian army, who I quoted from in episode 101. Even after Durova's secret was exposed, Durova continued wearing male clothes and living what most people of this era would have described as a male lifestyle. They used a whole range of pseudonyms, all of which were male. Russian is a gendered language, and Durova used the masculine to refer to themselves. When Durova's memoirs were published, they were supposed to be released under a male name. It was the publishers who chose to use the name Nadezhda Durova, and who picked the title, The Cavalry Maiden. Durova actually wrote to the publisher to complain about this. Quote, "The name which you called me in the preface haunts me. Is there no remedy for my grief? You called me by that name that makes me shudder, and soon 20,000 people will read it and call me by it too." End quote. That passage seems almost shockingly modern. An interesting side note, that publisher was none other than Alexander Pushkin, one of the most famous writers in Russian history. That passage seems to settle the question of Durova's true identity more or less definitively. However, the book itself is sometimes ambiguous. Durova sometimes describes themselves in feminine language, and compares themselves to female mythological and historical figures. I rewrote my own section on Durova several times. As I said at the beginning of this segment, scholars have a responsibility to approach these people on their own terms. Surely that includes using male language to describe someone who used male language to describe themselves, and referring to someone by the name they actually used. Unfortunately, as of now, the vast majority of existing scholarship disagrees. Almost everything written about this person uses the name Durova, and refers to them with female language. My rule with this stuff is to generally go along with consensus. For a lot of my listeners, this is their introduction to the subject. I feel like I have an obligation to not confuse them, and it's probably not a good idea for an amateur like me to start second-guessing scholarly consensus. I can understand why some people might be reluctant to apply what might feel like an anachronistic, modern transgender identity on Durova. But we know quite well how this person referred to themselves, and it was not as a woman named Nadezhda Durova. My guess would be in the future this person will be known mostly by their most commonly used pseudonym, Alexander Alexandrov, and generally referred to with male language. I have no idea what label might actually fit them. Maybe transgender does work. Maybe the lesson of all this is we need to get away from this whole concept of labeling people and putting them into categories, and just learn to accept that there's always been a lot of ambiguity in this world, and not everyone fits into some box. One last word, I don't like to preach, and I didn't approach this looking to offend anyone or make any partisan political point. This was a good question, and it deserved a thoughtful answer, so I tried to give it one. I tried to be thoughtful and respectful in my answer. Anyone who is willing to maintain that tone is welcome to give their thoughts as well. Anyone looking to get on their soapbox or disrespect other listeners will have their posts deleted and might lose their commenting privileges permanently. There are plenty of places on the internet to do that. This is not one of them. Anyway, before we go, I'd like to share a few more quotations from Rob Griffith's So Just and Glorious a Cause. This is a massive, highly detailed book. I could easily have made the Portuguese segment of last episode 3 or 4 times longer, and I still wouldn't have had time to cover all the interesting stuff in Rob's book. First, here's a quotation from Private Joseph Cooley of the 38th Regiment of Foot of the British Army. I like this quotation a lot because it clearly comes from an uneducated soldier. Looking at his spelling and grammar, it might be fair to say he wasn't fully literate. We don't often hear from these types of people. For obvious reasons, primary sources almost always come from either well-educated people or from people with a special natural flair for writing and language, or both. But these types were in the minority. Most Napoleonic-era European soldiers were poorly educated, and definitely not of a literary persuasion. In this passage, Private Cooley describes his first taste of combat, the Battle of Rolissa. Quote, "As soon as the enemy appeared in sight, I began with myself in this mayhem. I prepared to die, for this day many will be hurried out of time into eternity, and I perhaps may be one of them. My sins stood in array before me, and put me in far greater dread than the French that stood armed with their weapons of war. I then began to pray that the Lord would spare me, and if he did, I thought I would strive to be different for the future. The scene of slaughter that day was dreadfully terrific. One might think enough to soften the most obdurate heart. But alas, such is the depravity of the human heart, that it is not the scenes of human woes that we behold, though in their nature are so dreadful and affecting, that is sufficient to change the heart. For when we had caused our enemy to retreat, and the action had subsided, I considered myself safe, and went on in my mad career of sin." End quote. It's a great quotation for so many reasons. To fully appreciate it, I think you need to see some of the creative spelling. I posted a screenshot of the passage on the social media network formerly known as Twitter, if you'd like to take a look. Also, how many poorly educated teenagers today do you think know the word obdurate? Next is a quotation from someone we heard from several times in the last episode, Rifleman Benjamin Harris of the 95th Rifles. Here he describes a very sad incident from the aftermath of the Battle of Rolissa. Quote, "When the roll was called after the battle, the females who missed their husbands came along the front of the line to inquire of the survivors whether they knew anything about them. Amongst other names, I heard that of Calkin called in a female voice, without being replied to. The name struck me, and I observed the poor woman who had called it, as she stood sobbing before us, and apparently afraid to make further inquiries about her husband. No man had answered to his name or had any account to give of his fate. I myself had observed him fall, but as I looked at the poor sobbing creature before me, I felt unable to tell her of his death. At length, Captain Leach observed her and called out to the company, 'Does any man here know what has happened to Calkin? If so, let him speak out at once.' Upon this order, I immediately related what I had seen and told the manner of his death. After a while, Mrs. Calkin appeared anxious to seek the spot where her husband fell, and, in hope of finding him still alive, asked me to accompany her over the field. She trusted, notwithstanding what I had told her, to find him yet alive. 'Do you think you could find it?' said Captain Leach, upon being referred to. I told him I was sure I could, as I had remarked many objects whilst looking for cover during the skirmishing. 'Go then,' said the captain, 'and show the poor woman the spot, as she seems so desirous of finding the body.' I accordingly took my way over the ground we had fought upon, she following and sobbing after me, and, reaching the spot where her husband's body lay, pointed it out to her. She now soon discovered all her hopes were in vain. She embraced a stiffened corpse, and after rising and contemplating his disfigured face for some minutes, with hands clasped and tears streaming down her cheeks, she took a prayer book from her pocket and, kneeling down, repeated the service for the dead over the body. When she had finished, she appeared a good deal comforted, and I took the opportunity of beckoning to a pioneer I saw near with some other men, and together we dug a hole and quickly buried the body. Mrs. Calkin then returned with me to the company to which her husband had been attached, and laid herself down upon the heath near us. She lay amongst some other females, who were in the same distressing circumstances with herself, with the sky for her canopy and a turf for her pillow. End quote. A lot of you ask me for book recommendations. Rifleman Harris's memoirs, usually titled The Recollections of Rifleman Harris, would be near the top of my list. I think this is an especially easy one to get into if you've never read a primary source document before. It's also a must-read for any of you who are fans of the Sharp series. Harris served in the 95th Rifles, the same regiment as Sharp, and his memoir was the main source Cornwell used to create the novels. Finally, I thought we'd close with a less somber anecdote from Charles Leslie of the 29th Regiment of Foot, describing the action at Vimeru. Quote, "In this battle, the 60th Riflemen, who were all Germans, showed great tact in taking advantage of the ground, and dexterity in the use of their arms. General Fane, who commanded the light troops, observing one of these men successfully hit one or two French officers, who were gallantly exposing themselves in front, leading on their men, exclaimed, in the excitement of the moment, 'Well done, my fine fellow! I will give you half a doubloon for every other one you bring down.' The man coolly loaded again, fired, and hit another. Then, looking at the general, he said gravely, 'By Gott, I will make my fortune.'" End quote. The German accent there is written phonetically. I tried to be faithful to it. Apologies to our German listeners. That's all for now. I thought we'd close out with a piece of music. I mentioned this piece a few dispatches ago, Ludwig von Beethoven's Egmont Overture. It's been stuck in my head ever since. Here it is, performed by the Berlin Symphony Orchestra. Anyway, as always, thanks for listening.
Thank you.